Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fearless eyes.
Welcome to Court Appointed, TV perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer, dude, and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am still just a dude.
You know, we had a listener that wrote in, and I can't think of the name off the top of my head, but it was a suggestion that I should say I was a judge first, and then a lawyer, and then a dude. But I kind of get like in temporally speaking there, so I probably should say I'm a dude, a lawyer, and a judge, because that's kind of the order it happened. I was born a dude, I became a lawyer, and then became a judge.
So kind of like your evolutionary process.
That's right, my evolutionary process.
Well, then that means that everybody, that's right, that Mary says I haven't evolved. I'm still just a dude. I've started out a dude, and I'm still a dude. I've not moved anywhere. I'm stagnant.
I think she said you devolved was the actual...
Devolved. Yeah. I'm like a caveman. I've gone backwards.
So I know how you like your satellite radio and how you always talk about different stations on there. And usually the Led Zeppelin was the last one you talked about.
Oh, yeah.
But I discovered there's been a station that's been I've been listening to quite a bit. It's only for a limited time as well. It's the Beastie Boys station.
You know, I didn't know that until I saw an ad on there today. I had that screen up for some reason. Usually I just turn it on long enough just to click on the radio, and I happened to leave it up there for a little bit today, and I noticed that they have a Beastie Boy channel.
I've been bumping the Beastie Boys pretty much nonstop since I found out about it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I might have to turn that on some since Led Zeppelin is gone. I had to listen to the Dave Matthews channel there a little bit because the channel I usually listen to got overtaken by Coldplay. Uh-oh. They started putting on 24/7 Coldplay. Now, I like a few Coldplay songs, but to me, they don't have enough music for a whole channel 24/7.
Well, that's part of the same thing that's going on right now, because it was like Coldplay, Beastie Boys, I think Queen. There are a few other ones, but... The Beastie Boy one, that was the one that really piqued my interest, because I started thinking about it. I started listening to the Beastie Boys when I think it was in fifth or sixth grade, and I've listened to them pretty much my whole life. I think the Beastie Boys kind of, they're almost like the band that's kind of grown up with me to a certain amount, because, you know, when they started out back their early stuff, it was very kind of juvenile and whatever, but then they kind of grew up a little bit. And you know, when I was younger, I was kind of juvenile, too, and I grew up a little bit, at least I like to think. I evolved.
When you were younger, you were juvenile. That's right. But one or two of them's dead now, aren't they?
Yeah, one of them is, yeah.
One of them is? I knew one of them was. I wasn't sure about a second one.
Yeah, their book was really good, too. I actually listened to it on Audible, and it was really good. It was done differently than any other audiobook I've heard, because it was read by a lot of people who are fans of theirs. And then it also had excerpts from the Beastie Boys talking about like each little section. So it was almost like a really nice long story time too. So I would recommend that as well if you're a Beastie Boy fan.
No sleep till Brooklyn.
Yeah, see, that's the original stuff, the old school stuff.
Yeah. My mom got rid of my best porno mag.
Yep, that's the juvenile stuff right there. That's the stuff that I was snickering to when I was in fifth and sixth grade.
Yeah.
Like it was something.
Yeah, some of those lines just stick with you.
Yeah. Well, Sydney and Justin had an interesting topic on a recent episode of Sawbones. I think it was not this past week, but the week before.
Yes.
They were talking about amnesia, which led into the sister or sibling of amnesia, hypnosis.
Yeah, they were also talking about hypnosis being used for witnesses in trials and stuff like that, and how good of a practice that was. And so she said, "Dad, we just did one on hypnosis from a medical standpoint. Why don't you and Mike do one on it from a legal standpoint.
She had messaged me and asked me if I'd ever heard of it, and I said, no, I have not. But then I said, you know, there's probably some different standards for it. You would apply like you would any kind of other expert testimony or anything along those lines, and the court would look at it. And so I started researching a little bit, and it's kind of interesting. So we decided we would do an episode about hypnosis in the courtroom.
Well, not only that, it's kind of a popular thing, and it went through its period where it was very popular, maybe too popular.
Yeah, I found one or two cases that I think it maybe was a little bit too popular, and might still be a little bit too popular in one place. So before expert testimony comes in a courtroom, and this has to do with both civil and criminal litigation, the court has to make a determination about whether or not the expert testimony is important enough to come in, or believable enough, or credible enough, or whatever you want to say, whether or not the jury should even hear it. And we've discussed this a little bit before in some prior episodes. Don't ask me which one, because I don't really remember. But the difference was the Fry versus the Daubert standard. Do you remember us talking about that, Tommy?
Yes, I do remember that. And we, when we've had people on here as guests, we've had to swear them in as expert witnesses by the Dauber standard, wasn't it?
Well, that's true. We have actually asked them different expert qualifying questions to get them qualified as an expert to testify.
Right, and we determined that I'm not an expert in anything.
Or to podcast with us.
Yeah.
In order to be an expert to podcast on somebody, it's the McElroy standard. You have to ask them certain questions to make sure they're a sufficient podcaster.
I don't think there are any qualifications to be a podcaster. Everybody and their brother has one.
Yeah, that's true. So the Fry was the old test, and that's F-R-Y-E for those of you keeping score out there, how you spell Fry. And this test is the old one, like I said, and the Daubert is the new one that's generally accepted. But the Fry test is also known as the general acceptance test, and it looks to the scientific community to determine whether or not the evidence in question has a valid scientific basis. And if there's a significant dispute among experts in the relevant scientific community as to the validity of the scientific evidence, then it is not admissible. If the expert testimony does not concern novel theories or sophisticated technical matters, it need not meet stringent requirements for general scientific acceptance. So if something is generally accepted in the scientific community, then therefore that can come in as expert testimony. And that's pretty much the Fry test in a nutshell. So it's pretty strict, really, because you have to have kind of a consensus among the scientific community as to what is the valid test, or what is the valid idea with regard to something.
All right.
Now, the second one, which is the newer case and is pretty much used almost everywhere now, there's still a few exceptions, is the Daubert standard. And that comes from the Daubert v. Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals from a 1993 case. And there's different factors that the court looks at when determining whether or not expert testimony is valid or not. The first is whether the theory or technique in question can be and has been tested. The second is whether it has been subjected to peer review and publication. Three, its known or potential error rate. Four, the existence and maintenance of standards controlling its operation. And five, whether it has attracted widespread acceptance within the relevant scientific community. So it kind of lowers it a little bit. It doesn't make it that it has to be generally accepted, and it gives you a bit of leeway to get some different kinds of scientific evidence in that might not be generally accepted because it's so cutting edge. So we want to have some innovation in the courtroom and allow experts who are innovators to use their new theories in the courtroom to kind of move things along.
Well, that last one sounded like if it has become popular. I don't think that it should be based on if it has become popular, because it might be become popular for the wrong reasons.
Well, whether it's attracted widespread acceptance within the scientific community. The Daubert standard is what is used in all federal courts and most state courts. And the only places that the Fry system still is used is California, Illinois, Maryland, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington. Now, where it used to be was Florida. That was actually until May of 2019, so they just recently switched over, and the Florida Supreme Court said, no, we're going to follow the newer standard. So the Fry standard seems to be kind of phasing out of popularity in the country.
Well, Didn't know that there was two different kinds. I thought it was just the Daubert. Yep. And I'm surprised West Virginia has moved forward. We're one of the ones progressive and using the new standard.
Now, one of the cases that Sydney and Justin spoke about was the famous Chowchilla kidnapping cases. I think maybe we may have even talked about this in a prior episode some time ago. But it was the case where a school bus was essentially hijacked, and then some people took the kids and the bus driver and then buried them in almost like a tomb with some venting, and then demanded a ransom to tell the authorities where they were located. They end up escaping and whatnot, and they end up catching the bad guys. But one of the ways they caught them was because the bus driver, this gentleman named Ed Ray, he couldn't really recall any details to help the authorities figure out who had done this to them. He was pretty traumatized by it because all he could remember was kind of the horrors of what had happened. So they said, "Hey, Ed, how about we put you under hypnosis and see if you can remember something to help us figure out how to solve this?" And under hypnosis, he was supposedly able to remember the license plate of one of the kidnappers' vans, which took them to the quarry where they were buried. Supposedly, he remembered it exactly when it was only one number off as to what it was.
Hmm.
So, which leads me to believe that these guys were not very smart, number one, because they used their real license plate, first of all. But anyway, it's kind of an interesting story. But that was a very popular story back in the 70s. And it was kind of was very popular that hypnosis had been used to help solve a crime.
Yeah, I saw this. This was on like 48 Hours or Dateline or something like that here just a couple weeks ago. And I saw the story on that. And they kidnapped that whole school bus of kids. And then they had a trailer buried down in the ground. And that's what they loaded them down into, a makeshift door that they had made, and dropped them into this trailer. And they didn't see any of the guys because they were all wearing pantyhose over their face, so they couldn't tell what they looked like, you know, and that gives you pantyhose hair, so they would have looked a mess anyway. But but they did suspect. They had good suspicions who they thought it was, but they needed something to tie them together, and that's where they got him to come up with the license plate on it. But, you know, the funny thing is they never did actually demand a ransom for it.
Yeah, they never got around to doing it, did they?
Well, they tried, but what happened is this case, as soon as it happened, there were so many phone calls going on and people calling in, whether it was parents or concerned citizens, all these people calling in, it flooded the, you know, they didn't have 911 in those days, and it flooded the police switchboard, and they couldn't get through. They kept trying to get through to tell them the ransom. They couldn't get through on the switchboard. They decided to take a nap. So they all three took a nap. The three guys took a nap, and when they woke up, the kids had already been found.
That's funny.
They had broken out and got found.
But, well, yeah, they had. I think I read that they started stacking mattresses up on in that bus to try to get up there so they could get out.
Yeah, yeah. The kidnappers had dropped mattresses down in that, and so when the kids weren't really like lowered in, they were dropped through a hole landing on those mattresses. And so then they stacked them up, and a 14-year-old worked his way up out and got him the rest of the way out, got broke through the ground to get him out of there.
And the quarry was actually owned by the father of one of the three
kidnappers. Yep. So, yep, sure was.
They didn't really think it out too well.
No, and they put them together real quickly because all three of them served time together for some other crime they had committed. So once you found the one, it was real easy to figure out who the other two were with him.
All they needed was just a hypnosis to help pinpoint exactly the license plate to give them to tie it all together.
Yeah, and that was back in the 70s, I guess. And one of them is still in prison. Two of them are out, but one of them is still in prison, the ringleader.
Well, I mean, there's some other instances where courts have used hypnosis, and some of them are a bit grislier than this story we just heard. But before we get into that, I think there might be a pending motion before the court today.
Why, yes, if it pleases your honor, if he's not under the persuasion of hypnosis, we would like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
Hold on one second. Let me look at my palm. Okay.
You're getting sleepy.
I'm reading my palm. My palm says, let's go ahead. Let's do this.
All right, we have with us today our good friends from BetterHelp. That's H-E-L-P, BetterHelp.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals?
Boy, I'll say the COVID-19 situation. If there wasn't, I mean, if this isn't the perfect thing for people in this day and age, because you don't want to go into a crowded office.
Absolutely.
So here
not.
You can get help online. So you can maintain social distancing and get help. And they say that our mental health has greatly suffered through this lockdown.
BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, and you can start communicating in under 48 hours.
It's not a crisis line, and it's not a self-help line. It is professional counseling done securely online.
There's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas.
The service is available for clients worldwide.
You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor.
You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room trying to practice social distance as with traditional therapy.
BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed.
It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available.
BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today.
So, you can visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily. It is at www.betterhelp.com/reviews.
That's betterhelp.com. And join in the over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states.
And there's a special offer for court-appointed listeners. You get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/court.
10% off for betterhelp.com/court.
Now, while I was researching the hypnosis in the courtroom, I came across a case in New Mexico that was kind of interesting.
Aha!
Yeah, this is a case back again from the late 70s, early 80s. And the victim in this crime, she was awakened during the early morning hours of July 8th, 1980 by a male intruder in her bedroom. She was assaulted, and the defendant was arrested several days later and charged with an unrelated offense of a criminal contact with another woman. Now, while he was being held in the county jail for the trial of the other offense, he voluntarily agreed to appear in a lineup with two other men. And at that lineup, the victim was able to identify the voice of the defendant as that of her assailant, but was unable to make a positive visual identification. So, 7 weeks later, the prosecutor who was in charge of the case suggested that she undergo hypnosis to improve her recall and her ability to more positively ID the assailant. So, on August 28, 1980, she was hypnotized by the chief of the Roswell Police Department.
Roswell?
Yep. And
well, there's aliens involved in this.
The session was held at the police station and was also attended by the prosecuting attorney and several other individuals that were there with the police department. Now, they electronically recorded it and preserved it so it would be there for evidence to show later on what took place. And during the hypnosis session, the victim was shown a photographic array of several individuals, including the defendant. Both during the hypnosis and immediately thereafter, she identified the defendant as her assailant from the photographs. So after that, they charged this defendant with a felony offense for the crimes against the victim and was bound over for trial in the district court. So what you have is she IDs the voice. She can't ID the person by the face. So they do hypnosis, put pictures in front of her, and she can identify him. Seems pretty cut and dry, right?
I'm already seeing a problem with this. It's kind of like a game of the match game, because unless the pictures that she was shown after the hypnosis, unless those pictures were the exact same three people, then all you're doing is looking for the one that was also in that lineup, and bingo, that's your guy.
Well, I mean, it doesn't say it. That might have been the little trick they used there. But once the defense team learned that she had been hypnotized prior to trial, they moved to suppress because they said that the scientific technique of hypnosis is not reliable for enhancing memory of eyewitnesses, that correct scientific procedures were not utilized in this session, and that the hypnotist conducting it was not adequately qualified as an expert. So I don't know what the chief's qualifications were, but I don't know, they said that it wasn't adequate.
He dabbled in it.
So some additional grounds were that the use of hypnosis denied the defendant the right to confront the witness against him and to adequately cross-examine her, I guess because the witness was not going to be under hypnosis at the time. He was going to be cross-examined on the stand. I don't know. And that the defendant was denied due process of law because the hypnosis session was impermissibly suggestive to the witness. And the defendant was denied effective assistance of counsel because he was not represented by counsel or present at the time of the person performing the hypnosis. And by hypnotizing the complaining witness, the state had, in effect, destroyed material evidence in the case. They had destroyed the victim's independent recollection of the events that had happened. So that was what they had. That's what they argued, essentially, at the motion to suppress. The chief of Roswell said, he testified at the motion to suppress, that he had attended a four-day training seminar on hypnosis, that he was a member of two professional organizations related to hypnosis, and that he had hypnotized approximately 12 crime victims in prior cases under investigation. He detailed the procedures used in the incident case to hypnotize the victim and describe the results. And he was also
a magician.
He was. <It's> like, let me ask you another question.
Have you ever seen a man saw it in half?
Now, the defense team had a law professor from University of California who testified for the defense that had extensive training in both the theory and technique of hypnosis and was a licensed physician specializing in psychiatry. In addition to the medical training, he had extensively researched the phenomenon and had written on the subject. In his opinion, hypnosis is not a reliable scientific method for enhancing memory of a witness, and hypnotically induced recollections are less reliable than normal recollections. He further testified that the hypnosis session with the victim was unduly suggestive. Because of the unreliability of the hypnotically induced testimony generally and the improper procedures followed in this case, Dr. Diamond concluded that the victim was no longer a competent witness since her prior knowledge had been, in effect, destroyed. So they had an expert witness who said the same thing. Now, the state presented somebody else in opposition to Dr. Diamond. They had the testimony of Dr. Martin Reiser, who was the director of behavioral science at the LAPD, director of Law Enforcement Hypnosis Institute.
I didn't know there was such a thing.
Evidently, at that time, the LAPD had a director of Law Enforcement's Hypnosis Institute. Let me repeat that. And he was a former psychology professor and held a PhD in education and clinical psychology. In his opinion, hypnosis is a valuable and reputable scientific technique of proven value in both psychological treatment of individuals in criminal investigations. He further testified, in his opinion, the use of hypnosis to facilitate witness recall does not result in undue suggestibility of individuals if properly conducted. He also said that, "I am the director of a hypnosis institute, therefore I support it."
Yeah, because it pays me.
I made that last part up. That was my own little ad lib there.
But he was at all those other things without saying that. That's what they said.
Yeah. So after they heard all these witnesses, the court ruled on whether or not the evidence was going to be suppressed. And the court did not suppress all of the victim's testimony, but ordered that, number one, she would not be allowed to make in-court identification of the defendant. Two, the witness would not be permitted to testify to any evidence developed from the hypnotic session. And three, the witness would be permitted to testify to the events occurring on July 8th, 1980, and her voice identification of the defendant, but would not be permitted to testify to her identification of the defendant at any subsequent time, nor to testify to her identification of the defendant based on any subsequent events. So the court sided with the defense in that. They said, you know what, we think you probably kind of screwed the pooch on this one, and we're not going to let you bring that stuff in.
Well, I got to agree that whether it's a hypnosis or not, it didn't matter. That when she was shown three people, And she said, no, I can't identify him, but that one sounds like him. And then they show her him plus some other people. Well, this is the only one that matches the first three, so this must be the one. And she would automatically think, well, I've saw this guy. That's what would come to mind.
Yeah. Well, the state was not happy about this, so they filed an interlocutory appeal, and they raised two issues. And they said that the trial court abused its discretion in its determination that hypnosis was so unreliable a method of enhancing memory of a witness and was so impermissibly suggestive that testimony following hypnosis was inadmissible, and two, that the identification procedures employed in the case were so suggestive that they were likely to lead to misidentification. So they were, the state was not happy with this. They said, you know, we have our chief here who's a licensed by somewhere hypnosis expert, and he did everything right. So this went up on appeal to the New Mexico Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court heard all the arguments, and they said, you know what? The trial court had the first-hand opportunity to view the witnesses at the suppression hearing, and they said that although they find that the use of hypnotic procedures to revive a witness's recollection is not a matter of law improper, nor inherently impermissible when performed subject to appropriate safeguards, nevertheless, under the facts contained in the record herein, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in ordering the visual identification suppressed, and they affirmed it. So by doing that, they said, we're not going to per se rule out that all hypnosis recollection like that, but we're just not going to allow it in this case, which I thought that was kind of interesting. They had right. They had a chance to draw a bright line to say, no, this is all bunk, but we're not going to do it. They said, well, we're not going to rule it out, but in this case, we think that was right.
Well, I would agree with that, because it wasn't so much that they hypnotized her. It was the way they went about the whole identification thing was what caused the problem.
Yeah.
So I have to agree that would be right. Of course, I'm sure they care that I agree. They're all standing up saying, "Whoo, Tommy agrees. Boy, we did that one right."
Now, there's another case that case is kind of ancient history. That's from back in 1980. Now, there's another case that is still kind of going on a little bit. And this is a case that involves a gentleman by the name of Charles Flores. And he is a Texas prisoner who is on Texas death row right now.
Okay.
And there was a hypnosis in his case that was kind of strange. And I'm going to go through the facts of it and we'll kind of get procedurally where we are. So the witness was a Dallas woman named Jill Bargainer, lived next door to the victim in this case. And early on the morning of January 1998, Bargainer thought she saw two white men get out of a yellow Volkswagen Beetle parked in her neighbor Betty Black's driveway. A couple of hours later, Betty's husband came home from work to find Betty and their Doberman, Santana, shot dead. Later that day at a local police station, Bargainer identified the driver of the car in a number of photo arrays. He turned out to be the boyfriend of Betty's daughter-in-law and owned a pink and purple VW Beetle with a flame design running down the side. That's a pretty obvious-looking vehicle.
Yeah, you see two white guys in a pink VW, that's something.
with flames running down the side.
Yeah, that's a girl car. That's not a guy car.
So 5 days later, the police asked her, the bargainer, the witness, to help to create a sketch of the passenger. But by this time, she was kind of unraveling. She said she couldn't sleep. She couldn't stop thinking and ask if they could hypnotize her so that she could relax and do a good composite, supposedly her exact words. So she couldn't really remember how she knew that hypnosis was something they might offer, but that was supposedly how it came about. She asked for it. But okay. That was a little in the air, a little fishy there already.
Yeah.
So the next day, there was a patrol officer who was trained in forensic hypnosis, and they hypnotized Bargainer.
Why can't they just get a real hypnosis? Why do they keep having cops do it?
Listen to this. It was his first and last forensic hypnosis he ever performed.
He flunked out of the LAPD school of hypnosis and whatever
this,
it was.
Well, this was in Texas. So I don't know. Maybe Texas has its hypnosis department, too. So they recorded that in the video, too, and the officer tells her to imagine she is sitting in a cinema holding a remote control. She can use the remote anytime she likes to stop the film or fast forward. Hypnotists call this the movie theater technique. and it's often been used to help emotionally traumatized witnesses feel that they can control their memories. She mentioned a few different details during the course of the hypnosis. The first suspect was holding a beer bottle. The second had brown eyes, but nothing that was really important. At the end of the session, the officer told her that she would be able to recall more of the events as time goes on. And after the hypnosis, she helped the police draw a composite sketch of the passenger she thought she saw, a thin Caucasian man with long hair. Police then showed her a series of photo arrays, including images of the person they believed to be the passenger, who was a heavy-set, brown-skinned, short-haired Latino man who had been caught setting the VW on fire 2 days after the murder, Charles Flores.
That's pretty suspicious.
Yeah, well, it is. But Flores did not match the description she had given, because she kept saying it was a Caucasian guy.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So the prosecutors gathered enough circumstantial evidence to prosecute Flores, and at his trial, 13 months after the killing, Bargainer was called as a witness. But after she took the stand, the defense called for a zany hearing. I'm going to call it a zany hearing. So hypnosis is so popular in Texas that there is a Supreme Court decision out there in Texas called the Zany case. And there's 10,
zany case?
There's 10 different factors that the court is supposed to go through to determine whether or not hypnosis is going to be allowed into a court hearing.
Or if it's just zany.
I know, you can't make this name up.
It's Looney Tunes.
So the different things they look at are, number one, the level of training in the clinical uses and forensic application of hypnosis by the person performing the hypnosis. Two, the hypnotist's independence from law enforcement investigators, prosecution, and defense. Three,
well, I just failed the first two.
The existence of a record of any information given or known by the hypnotist concerning the case prior to the hypnosis session. Four, the existence of a written or recorded account of the facts as the hypnosis subject remembers them prior to undergoing hypnosis. Five, the creation of recordings of all contacts between the hypnotist and the subject. Six, the presence of persons other than the hypnotist and the subject during any phase of the hypnosis session, as well as the location of the session. Seven, the appropriateness of the induction and memory retrieval techniques used. Eight, the appropriateness of using hypnosis for the kinds of memory loss involved. Nine, the existence of any evidence to corroborate the hypnotically enhanced testimony. And 10, the presence or absence of overt or subtle cueing or suggestion of answers during the hypnotic session. So after a hearing on those factors, which you very astutely noticed they failed.
Yeah.
Quite a few off the bat there. They allowed her to take the stand, and she identified Flores sitting there at the defense table as the second man she saw that morning. So based upon that, he was convicted, and he was sentenced to death. And he's actually still sitting on death row. And as recently as May of 2020, the Texas Supreme Court actually upheld the conviction, saying that the hypnosis in this case was correct and they allowed it. So he is still sitting on death row. There is no date for his execution. They haven't asked for one, but he still has some appellate procedures remaining through the federal system. But as of right now, I mean, this guy was convicted on that, which is amazing to me.
Well, it is amazing, but I would like to know, what is his excuse for burning the Volkswagen? Is it just he didn't like pink Volkswagens with flames on them or something?
Well, I think the reason he may have done that, he's not a good guy, first of all. He was a member of supposedly the Mexican mafia and had, you know, kind of ties to gangs and organized crime and things like that. So, I mean, he was not...
That MS-13?
No, I think this was probably... Well, it may have been that. I don't know. But by all accounts, I mean, he was not a good person. So... I think they probably didn't really care, the police, to some extent. Like, if they were putting him away for this, it didn't matter, because they knew he wasn't a good person to begin with.
So they probably had the attitude, if he didn't do this, he probably did something else he deserved it for.
Yeah, probably. And, I mean, you know, who knows why he did that. I mean, something maybe stuck out a little bit, like a, you know, Volkswagen he thought it'd be fun to burn. Who knows? Like, who knows what goes through people's heads? Like, this is one of those things, I mean... I don't know that he had a really good excuse, but the thing is they couldn't really identify him but for this hypnosis. I mean, it's kind of kind of strange. So I don't really know that it matters why he burned it. I don't think he has to prove his innocence. They have to prove their case. And I don't, based on this, I don't know that they did.
But they weren't looking for him when he was caught burning that Volkswagen, right? They didn't know about him.
No. They thought they were looking for a Caucasian person with long hair, not a brown-skinned person with a shaved head.
So they catch him burning this Volkswagen. They say, that was the getaway vehicle the night of this murder, so he must have been involved. So then they went back to the only witness and said, can you do us a favor and put him at the scene of the crime?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, that's kind of backwards police work. You want them to already have him under suspicion, and then he does something like that that you say, oh, well, look, now he's covering up evidence because he's being closed in on.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like hypnosis in the court system is kind of falling out of vogue, and it seems like Texas is kind of one of the last holdouts of it. Listen, in my brief dive into hypnosis in the courtroom.
Well, I found some stuff. It said that the question of a witness's competency to testify following questioning under hypnosis is guided in federal courts by Rule 601 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, which provides every person is competent to be a witness except as otherwise provided in these rules. However, in civil actions and proceedings with respect to an element of a claim or defense as to which state law supplies a rule of decision, the competency of a witness shall be determined in accordance with state law. The federal courts addressing the issue of hypnotically induced testimony of a prosecution witness have generally permitted the use of such testimony, holding that the fact of the hypnosis affects only the credibility of the witness and not the witness's competence or the admissibility of his or her testimony.
Yeah, so see, the problem I have with that, and this harkens back to one of the quotes, the Innocence Project filed a brief in this Flores case I just was talking about, and they had a really good quote. And they said, memory can be easily contaminated, just like a crime scene.
Well, that's true.
So I think if you contaminate this person's memory by doing this hypnosis, then you have, in effect, spoiled the evidence that you were trying to obtain.
Well, it said that people being put under hypnosis, now I don't know how well hypnosis works or not. I guess I'm kind of a skeptic as to how well it works. I'm sure there's plenty of people that will say it saved their life or whatever for some reason or another.
Well, yeah, but for therapeutic purposes, what's the harm in it?
Yeah,
I mean, if it works, it works. Like, you know, I had a car accident and I tried acupuncture with needles to help. You know, I don't know. I mean, it seemed like it might have helped, but who cares? What does it hurt? Try whatever you want.
But what it says is that they're particularly susceptible to suggestion, and great care must be exercised to ensure that statements while under hypnosis are the production of the subject's own recollection rather than of recall tainted by suggestion received while under hypnosis.
Well, and see, that's the purpose of those factors that are outlined by that Texas case, the zany factors. I don't know if it's pronounced zany, but I'm gonna keep calling them the zany factors. But
why not?
If you see what they are, they're essentially trying to remove any kind of issue with the person being tainted from suggestion and whatnot. But as you can see, even from this case, the Flores case, it was readily apparent that it failed all these factors. Yet he was still convicted, and the Supreme Court still upheld it in Texas. So how does that happen? I don't know.
Well, the first thing I would say is the hypnotist should be an independent body. He or she should not be working with the defense or the prosecution.
Well, that's one of the factors.
It should be an independent person. And then it says that everybody needs to be in the room that's concerned. So, you know, the people for the defense, people for the prosecution, it should be at least the audio tape made and preferably a videotape made so that everybody that's there is accounted for and all things are accounted for. Like if a person says, do you remember, you know, what color his shirt was? No, I don't remember. Well, couldn't you picture him in a yellow shirt? Oh yeah, he was wearing a yellow shirt. You know, that's the kind of questioning that you have to watch for as to, did the person really recall this or was it being suggested to him? It's like some of these bad interviews that we've seen where people false confess. where they keep them in a room and don't let them out for 36 hours, and they keep on and on and on. I'm your friend. You got to roll over on the other one first so you'll get out. Don't you remember? He took the gun and shot the guy. You just watched, right? Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right. Same kind of thing.
It is to a certain degree. This is a bit more subtle, I think, but you're right. I think that everybody needs to be in the room where it happens.
Just like in Hamilton.
That's right.
Now, there was a period.
That's the kind of chemistry you can't just teach in podcasting school. You have to like pick up on these subtle cues like that and just throw them back and forth.
In the late 80s and 90s, the question of admissibility of hypnotically refreshed or enhanced testimony went into a state of flux, largely caused by cases involving uncorroborated allegations of child sexual abuse following regressive therapy or other forms of hypnosis-related therapy to bring out repressed memories of childhood incidents. This series of cases saw many convictions later reversed on appeal based upon a rethinking of the admissibility issue, and the eventually resulted in the adoption in the federal courts of a case-by-case approach in which the court has discretion to balance all the factors to determine the reliability of the evidence and the probative versus prejudicial effect of the testimony. In the Second Circuit's lengthy analysis of the admissibility case law leading up to Borowick, that was a Borowick v. Shea, the court noted that sometimes the safeguards that may be required by the trial court, supra, may not be enough to ensure the reliability of the testimony, and the defense may still be able to demonstrate by expert testimony that a witness's memory has been irreparably distorted by hypnosis. The Second Circuit concluded that the district court was correct in issuing a pretrial in limine. We went over that.
Yep.
In limine order that barred the admissibility of the plaintiff's hypnotically refreshed memories revealed during regression therapy of her aunt's alleged child abuse from over 20 years earlier. While the court had indicated that hypnosis conducted as part of the therapy might be more inherently reliable than refreshing a witness's memory under the pressure of a criminal investigation, still the plaintiff's far-fetched, uncorroborated accusation against a number of people, which included fanciful allegations of ritual rape and abuse without strong corroboration, weighed against admissibility. So they were saying that, you know, that, okay, if you're going to make these kind of claims, and they're that, you know, they're that overboard ritualistic, you know, things and everything. You got to have something somewhere, another person, some form of physical evidence, something to back that up. Because otherwise you just make up a story and we're just supposed to say, well, they were hypnotized, so it must be true.
Yeah. Need a little something else. Bit more meat on the bone.
Yeah. Yeah. Or something that can back that up. I came across some cases that involve, besides that one that we talked about earlier, the Cowchilla kidnapping. Forensic hypnosis has been used in some other high-profile cases, such as the Boston Strangler, Ted Bundy, and Sam Shepard. First of all, forensic hypnosis must be conducted by a trained professional who knows how to get information out. Secondly, very exacting procedures and standards must be met during the hypnosis session. It says one successful case is that of serial killer Ted Bundy. He was a handsome, charming stranger who stalked young grade school and college girls and confessed to killing more than 30 of them. No one knows for sure how many women Ted Bundy killed starting in 1974. And there was one of the girls that one of the his famous murders happened in a sorority house.
In Gainesville. I think
Florida State, right?
I think it was in Gainesville.
Was it Gainesville?
I
was thinking it was Florida State. Maybe it was Florida. On January 15, 1978, Nita Neary returned to her Chi Omega sorority house and saw a man running down the stairs with a club in his hand. She saw the profile of his face. Four girls living in the house had been brutally beaten. Two of them died. 1 week later, Nina was put into a hypnotic state and questioned. She selected a photo of Ted Bundy from a photo lineup. So she had seen a silhouette of his face, but it sounds like this was fairly legitimate because if they hadn't, you know, they didn't show him a picture of Ted Bundy and then say, now pick Ted Bundy out of a lineup.
Yeah.
They just showed her standard lineup, and with that therapy, then she was able to.
I just looked. It actually was Florida State. You were right.
I thought so. I rarely make mistakes, but you'll learn that, counselor. After two escapes from prison and 11 years of trials and appeals, Ted Bundy was convicted for two counts of first-degree murder in the Chi Omega killings and a death sentence for the murder of Kimberly Leach. Let's see. In the case of Sam Shepard, forensic hypnosis saved an innocent man. Sam Shepard, he was a doctor, and he's the one, we've talked about this before, that the movie and the television series from the 60s, I guess it was, The Fugitive, was based on.
And also a newer movie starring Harrison Ford.
Yes. So he was convicted of murdering his wife, even though he consistently claimed that a bushy-haired murderer did it. Now, in the TV series, it was a one-armed man. Mm-hmm. Dr. Sam Shepard was later legally exonerated of all charges. It began in July 1954 when Marilyn Shepard went to bed, leaving her husband Sam downstairs where he fell asleep watching television. Sam awoke to his wife's calls and found her being beaten by an intruder. He struggled with the man and was knocked unconscious by a blow to the head. The media spin of the events included an affair and rumors of Sam's dark side, which resulted in a conviction. After 10 years in jail and various appeals, Sam Shepard's case returned to court. His defense was conducted by the now famous and brilliant trial lawyer, F. Lee Bailey. Remember who else he defended?
OJ.
Yeah. OJ, yep. Throughout the trial, F. Lee Bailey was able to convince jurors that the original police investigation had been sloppy, ignoring evidence such as a cigarette butt in the toilet, although no one in the house smoked, and that no motive had been established for why Dr. Shepard would kill his wife. So they used hypnosis, and he was able to give them a better description, and eventually Sam Shepard was released. And then they used hypnosis in the case of Albert DeSalvo, a.k.a. the Boston Strangler. 13 women were killed in Boston from the summer of 1962 to January of 1964, all victims of a serial killer who liked to sexually molest and kill the women in their apartment by strangling them with articles of their clothing. None of the killings gave any indication of forced entry, which means women had let the killer into their homes. Five police jurisdictions eventually became involved, interviewing over 30,000 people. So in 1961, Albert Salvo was arrested for posing as a modeling agent, knocking on women's doors. These women who were interested had allowed him inside where he measured them and then sometimes had sex with them. And then he changed his methods and in 1964 was arrested for entering women's apartments and raping them. He would either talk or force his way in. The police psychiatrist believed that Albert Salvo was moving through a psychosexual stages in which murder of these women were the next logical progression. Again, his lawyer was F. Lee Bailey. So I guess he decided he did a good job with the other one, so he decided to have him help him.
Well, what I understand is how some of these guys afford F. Lee Bailey these high-profile cases. I'm sure they don't have the money to hire him.
I think that they do it for the fame.
Yeah,
I think the lawyers take this on because of the fame, because think of how that boosts your practice, and so you can charge more money to everybody else.
Yeah.
That's what I would guess.
I've had a client try to sell me on that before. You know what I told him?
What?
Go find another lawyer. Guess what? I'm not a famous lawyer. I don't know. It just seemed like a ploy to me, like, hey, yeah, I don't have any money to hire you, but I'll gladly give you a cheeseburger tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll gladly put your name in the paper and say, this guy's a pretty good lawyer.
Yeah, don't think so. I'm sorry, the fame and fortune he promised me tomorrow does not pay my bills today to keep my lights on.
But F. Lee Bailey was convinced Albert DeSalvo was telling the truth, and part of the interrogation included putting DeSalvo under hypnosis. Hypnosis? How about hypnosis?
That sounds better.
Okay. While hypnotized, DeSalvo described the murder of one of the women, Evelyn Corbin. During his session, he was able to give details that he couldn't have known unless Evelyn Corbin had told him herself, including information about her medical condition and a warning from her doctor to not have sex. Descriptions of other murders and the women involved had similar results, though enough to convince the police detectives.
Yeah.
So he kind of was hypnotized and gave himself up.
Yeah.
Well, so that worked just the opposite.
Yeah.
They tried using hypnosis in Robert Kennedy's assassination and the kidnapping of Jimmy Hoffa, but they didn't have any results from that. But they did try to use it.
We still don't know where Jimmy Hoffa is.
No, although they say he's buried under concrete, like at Old Shea Stadium or something like that. I don't remember what it is now.
I thought it was the Meadowlands.
Well, it could be. It was somewhere. I remember somewhere in New York or New Jersey, whatever. I don't remember the exact location.
Somewhere up there.
Yeah. You know, they had a movie out. That movie was out just not too long ago that covered that.
Yeah. I watched it. It was pretty good.
That 3-hour movie.
Yeah, it was on Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah. What was that called? I forget.
I can't remember.
No.
It came out on, I think it came out on Christmas Day. I sat down and watched the whole thing on Christmas Day.
Really?
Yeah,
you don't have anything better to do on Christmas Day than watch a 3-hour movie?
Nope, that's it.
Well, you're a lucky man.
Drink eggnog. You know, I'm pick up the wrappers pretty much as they get open, so I try to do that pretty efficiently, so I'm not doing it all day. So.
And I guess the boys are old enough, there's no toys to put together.
No, not usually. Just lots of batteries.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's going to bring us to...
Legal
briefs. So legal briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal terms we talked about, and I got a couple good ones today.
Good, hit me with your best shot.
So, what is the difference between the Fry versus the Daubert standard for expert witnesses?
Well, the Fry is the older one. Daubert is more current, and while some states have not adopted it, some are still using the Fry. Most states have adopted it, including Florida, which just adopted it in 2019.
Yeah. What's the difference, though, substantively?
Oh, well, Daubert, I was hoping to get away with that answer.
It was a good one. I mean, it was getting deep and thick in here. I was wading through it.
Sounded like I knew what I was talking about,
well,
didn't it?
I think you do know what you're talking about.
Well, the Daubert one, it leaves more things open to the imagination, more cutting-edge technology and stuff with it, as opposed to the Fry was very strict and based on old standards.
That's true. And which is the general acceptance test is the Fry standard, pretty much. It has to be generally accepted in the field. So,
all right.
That's a good one. You did well on that one.
Well, thank you.
Now, after the court ruled against the state in the case in New Mexico, I said the prosecution took an interlocutory appeal. Do you know what that means?
An interlocutory appeal?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. It means that they appealed the decision for some reason.
That means they appealed it during the trial itself. So they didn't wait. They did not wait until the very end. They said, we think that decision was such an important thing that we're going to go ahead and file the appeal now. And we want the court to hear it now. Not at the end of the case, but right now. So it kind of is like you basically take the original case, put it on hold for a little bit, and then go into the appeal.
Why would they let you do that? Why don't they make you finish it just in case it goes the way you want? Then you shouldn't have appealed.
Well, I mean, there's certain things that might be so egregious, you need to have it appealed right then and there. So
I've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah.
Let's put this on hold. Don't give me your answer right now. I'm going to go to another court and see what they think, and then I'll get back with y'all whether I need you or not.
It's a thing.
All right.
And then the last question. This comes from something you said while you were reading to me about one of your cases.
Yeah?
You said Supra.
Supra.
What does Supra mean?
Well, it used to be a Toyota model.
It still is. It's back.
Oh, is it? Okay, yeah. I didn't know.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard of them in a while.
They're pretty sweet. Vin Diesel drove one in the Fast and the Furious, I think. Or no, not Vin Diesel. It was Paul Walker, I think. That was his.
Well, I didn't know what it meant. All I knew was that it was kind of stuck in there, looked like a footnote or something like that.
It kind of is, yeah. So Supra, when you see it in a legal writing, it's Latin. It means above. And it's a citation you use when you're referring to a case that has been cited above. Like you're saying, so you don't have to write out the entire case again.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
And if you want to get really good at that, you'd bust out your blue book, which is the legal book of citations, which tells you how to cite all things. And you look in your blue book, kind of like looking it up in your Funk and Wagnalls.
Oh, it's a Blue Book. I thought it was some other one that had all that in there, some type of legal dictionary or something like that.
Well, there's Black's Law Dictionary, but that's just definitions.
Yeah.
The Blue Book.
That was the one I was thinking of.
Yeah. So the Black's Law Dictionary is definitions. The Blue Book is for citations, but there's actually a Maroon Book, too, which has citations. So.
Well, I think it's quite fitting that the lawyer's books will beat you black and blue.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Hello. Welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is history. When we study history in school, it seems that the people involved in these historic events must have been aware of the impact of their actions. I mean, how could you be signing the Declaration of Independence and not be thinking, people will read about and remember me for centuries? Whether you were a general that led our country to some great wartime victory, or leader of a civil rights movement, or involved in the trial of the century, surely you are aware that what you are doing will be remembered and talked about forever, right? As big as these things may seem to us looking back, I don't think that the people in that present situation realize the significance of what they are doing. I think if they were thinking that, then they were not doing it for the right reason, and therefore it is not as significant. It is the common guy doing what he thinks was right at the time and not expecting anything beyond his actions other than the improvement for his fellow man that this event can bring about, but not that he will be remembered. So if history is filled with ordinary people doing what they thought were ordinary things that are later deemed extraordinary, then those things could be occurring right now. Between the pandemic, the financial crisis, and the protest over Black Lives Matter, I feel history is being created right now. This is a turning point in American life as we knew it. I believe things are going to be forever changed due to several of these things and several of the people involved. This is a historical moment that people will point to years from now and say, I remember back in 2020 when the world kind of fell apart, and here are the events that led to this particular change. History isn't easy, and history isn't fun. It is often born in pain, suffering, and the blood of those that were trying to make what they believe was the right thing. Some pay the ultimate sacrifice. Would civil rights have come about when they did without the assassination of Dr. King and John and Robert Kennedy? I don't know, but it sure made us all stop and look at what they were saying and where we as a nation were headed. I think we are doing that now. We are stopping and taking a look at what has happened in our country and deciding if we are willing to accept it. We can't be held responsible for not acting on what we don't know about or don't understand. However, I don't think we can use that excuse anymore. If you have two eyes, you can see what is happening, and you have to be willing to say something has to change. Maybe we had a pandemic to make us all stop long enough to see and act upon the systemic racism that is still rampant all these years since the civil rights law passed in 1964. Maybe we finally see that we still have a long way to go. So maybe this is history happening, and someday you will explain to your grandchildren how all of these events came about to create a fundamental shift in how we treat each other as human beings, and we actually believe that all men are created equal. It won't be easy, and it won't happen overnight, and there are those that are making the ultimate sacrifice to make us all understand. But if enough of us believe, and let it begin with me, then we just might make history together. This has been Tommy's Random Thoughts.